you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me once again is my pal and boss, Dan Greenfield. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to have you back on the show. Now, the last show you did, the last episode of Treasury Cast you did, was Rudolph Summer Fun,
which
was a while ago. Now, I know you're a much bigger Rudolph fan than you are a Batman fan.
That's true.
But I hope you can muscle your way through this episode where we'll be talking about Limited Collector's Edition number C-59, Batman's Strangest Cases. Dan, of course, like, did you have this one as a kid?
Well, I got it later. It was not one of the original ones that I had had, like, when I was a kid. I had a few of them, but not this one. But I did get this when I was like in my early 20s. So if that's considered still being a kid, then yes. But not when it came out in 1978.
When I was in my 20s, I would not have thought of myself as a kid. But now that I'm older, I'm like, yeah, I was still a kid.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
DC really was firing on all cylinders during these late period treasuries. They did, of course, the Ra's al Ghul collection, which you and I covered on the show a while ago. I mean, with, you know, a Neil Adams cover, a collection of some of the greatest Batman material ever. I mean, I feel like they could have done these forever. And it's ironic because this issue is the very last issue of Limited Collector's Edition. After this, they did a couple of DC special series, but this was kind of – they went out with a bang because this book is magnificent.
Yeah, it really is. It's a great survey of Bronze Age Batman is what it is. I mean, it's all for 1978 recent stuff. It is like in the same way that the Ra's al Ghul stuff is, you know, recent stuff also. This also is – it's sort of a – kind of a proto version of a trade paperback,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the sense that it's not from the Golden Age and Silver Age and a big survey across X number of years. It's all relatively recent stuff that they repackaged and beautifully too. I mean, that the story selection, I have to say, is really terrific.
Yes, it is.
And I do love the cover. I also noticed something that if you look carefully at Batman's figure, and it's a great figure of Batman and Robin by Adams. It's just good God. For those who are listening, it's them in, like, you know, it's almost like a riff of, I guess, what is it, Batman number 9, where Batman and Robin are in the spotlight.
In the spotlight,
yeah. But anyway, I noticed that Adams did something here that he would do in later years, but was really kind of a no-no. He actually gave Batman eyeballs. If you look carefully at that image, there are little eyeballs that he kind of sketched in there, which I think is kind of funny that he was trying to get away with that because it was obviously not the house style. But for Batman...
Oh, you're right. I've never noticed that. Wow.
I know, right? Isn't that wild? I mean, for Batmanophiles, this is kind of an interesting tiny little footnote. But I just love the whole thing that the pages from the various comics that they're lifting from are floating around them like garbage on the street. I think it's just – I mean, it's atmospheric. It is such a great cover. I love it. I'm not sure if it was inked by Giordano or not. I'm not 100% sure. I don't think so, but it is a wonderful cover.
It is. Graphic design-wise, though, I have to say – I always noticed that, obviously, when they made the Batman logo, the 70s Batman logo, they didn't have the S. So when they whoever created it, whether it was Gaspar Saladino or I don't know who might have, or Ira Schnapp or whoever might have done, although this was probably past Ira Schnapp.
No, this is Schnapp that died by that.
Okay, yeah. But I mean, like, obviously, when they did it, they just came up with Batman, B-A-T-M and N. And then at some point they were like, well, we do need to pluralize this, so can you put up an S? And the S just doesn't look right. I can't tell you why it doesn't look right, but it just doesn't look right.
Well, it's also because your eye is accustomed to seeing the Batman logo where Bat and Man are separated at this time, with the Batman face in between them over the back.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And so you see it all jammed together and with the S, and it definitely looks – it feels rushed a little bit, you know, because – and the strangest cases below, which of course is – kind of been made humorous since, and people use the term Batman's strangest cases like they did on Batman the Brave and the Bold and and where they do a lot of the wacky episodes. But it you're right about the logo. It is a little on the strange side, pardon the pun.
Yeah. The other nice detail is this mentions creators on the cover, which was pretty unusual for this time. Of course, now starting in the 80s, it became pretty regular. Now that comic creators are rock stars, they get their names all over the place. But this was still kind of unusual to go out of their way and say, hey, there's material in here by Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson, Frank Robbins, Dick Giordano, Irv Novik. I mean, this probably might be the only time Irv Novik ever got his name on a cover. I can't imagine another context where that might have happened.
You might be right about that. It's true. And it's interesting that you point that out, because I didn't even, you know, I kind of went right past that. But you're right. This was kind of the dawn of the age of the superstar creator. Yep. It's not to the degree necessarily that it is today, although I've got lots to say about the Adams front about that when we get to it. But, yeah, to see that, you know, all these were big names in comics at the time, particularly the first four names there, O'Neill, Adams, Wein, and Wrightson. Giordano was always, you know, the inker. And I think, of course, obviously, to be fair, they put Robbins and Novik on the cover too, but they were not at the same level as the other four on this, you know, in terms of fans' hearts, as terrific as they are. I don't mean to knock them, but, you know, there is a big difference between Neil Adams and Irv Novik. But it is really, really cool to see all of that now that you mention it.
I wonder if that mattered to him. You know, I wonder if somebody like Irv Novik, who was kind of just like a jobber, and again, I don't mean that as a pejorative,
right? Exactly.
But he was not. I don't think Irv Novik thought of himself as a superstar creator.
No, the way Bernie Wrightson and Neil Adams
were kind of treated. So he must have been like, "Oh, look at that! Hey, my name's on a cover. Like, it's very exciting." So yeah, it's a tremendous cover, and minus the trade dress, this would be a great poster. I mean, it's just such a beautiful image. I mean, you could just make it as this is just Batman rummaging through his. You know, some of his cases. I mean, it just works by itself. So, yeah, it's a really beautiful cover. And DC, you know, they knew how to pull out all the stops. I mean, you know, Neil Adams, man, with these Treasury covers, Superman versus Muhammad Ali, Ra's al Ghul. I mean, my God, the guy he was just knocking it out of the park. So.
It's ridiculous. I mean, how you know, at the height of his powers, and he still was here. I mean, this isn't even – I mean, he wasn't even at this point doing much in the way of interiors. He was really just doing, you know, cover work for DC because he was, you know, he had – all this other work that he was doing and what have you. But yeah, it's a killer cover. And if he had drawn it years before, then you could see that the Batman and Robin probably would have been used as, you know, merchandising imagery or as, you know, as the logo on the cover or whatever, because it is such a striking look. And, you know, he didn't draw Robin all that often but you know, by the time that he and O'Neill were doing it, Batman was, you know, Dick Grayson had left for college.
Right.
So there is something really nice and golden agey about the whole thing. The fact that they're together here, it just makes for a really, really cool cover.
Yeah, it's very, very nice. So, all right, let's get right to it. So inside cover is the table of contents. And then
keep in mind, I'm sorry, I just realized that Robin is actually not in the comic. He's not in the Treasury.
No, I guess he is. No. I never thought about that, but you're right.
Yeah.
Jeez, I can't believe I've had this book for 40 years and I've never thought about that, but you're right. There's no Robin stories there.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I'll forget it. Let's just end the show now. Let's wrap up. This book is trash. So, So inside, as I said, it's the table of contents, and then we get right to the first story, which is by the way, I should mention this Treasury was on sale April 4th, 1978. The first story is A Red Water, Crimson Death from Brave and Bold, number 93, by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, of course. Batman pursues a criminal to a mysterious house in Gotham City. The gunman gets the drop on Batman, but his gun misfires. Batman then apprehends him. Commissioner Gordon recommends a vacation, to which the Cape Crusader reluctantly agrees. Bruce Wayne boards a steamship bound for Ireland. Along the way, he saves the life of a young boy who falls overboard during a storm. When the ship stops at the Aran Islands to drop off the boy, Bruce also disembarks. He's given a place to stay by the boy's uncle. Later, Bruce learns that many on the island, including the boy's parents, were killed by a red tide which poisoned all the fish. Batman investigates and finds that Aloysius Cabot, a fishery owner, has been using a haunted castle to scare away the locals. He was responsible for the poison water. When Batman is himself poisoned, he is helped by the ghost of King Hugh to find the antidote. Cabot is killed when King Hugh's portrait falls off the wall and breaks Cabot's neck. Okay, Dan, what do you think of this unusual team-up of Batman and the House of Mystery?
I think it's fantastic. And I'll give you a little backstory context. For the last few years, and I think we've talked about this, I've been doing a Bronze Age reread, and I recently got into the Bronze Age. I mean, I started like 3 years ago, started in 1964 with the new look, and I've been reading Batman and Detective in the order that they came out. And I've been just going forward, and I figured I'm going to go at least until the, you know, the early 80s. But I'm just now in 1970. And, you know, recently, of course, and I know this is a little bit of a long-winded answer, but I'll make my point. Just recently, I had made the decision that I was going to leave Brave and the Bold out, and I was going to do that as kind of a separate thing. And when Denny O'Neil died recently, I did a story at 13th Dimension, the top 13 Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams, you know, collaborations. And I got to tell you, when I read this for preparing for this podcast, I had completely forgotten about this story. I'd completely forgotten that it was Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams. And I remembered that there was the House of Mystery and that Adams had done the art, but I'd forgotten that O'Neil had written the story. And it is great. It is suspenseful. It's got a sense of humor about it. It's well written. The art is absolutely gorgeous. And I certainly would have included it in my top 13 if I had the presence of mind to recall this. But because I haven't been reading up on Brave and the Bold, it had slipped my mind. And I got to tell you, I regret it, because it is a terrific story with shifting tones, well written. I mean, this is O'Neil crackling. And the story layout and the way this all plays together, because at the time, Batman was dealing a lot with supernatural stuff anyway. That part of the early 70s was, you know, in a push to get him back to, like, sort of his golden age roots. He did a lot of gothic stuff. He did a lot of, like, unexplained stuff, which is also why The Strangest Cases really works as a trade. But this one is just brilliant. And I also love the thing that you mentioned where Gordon forces him to take a vacation. and there's this one panel where Gordon is saying, look, you know, you're no good to me dead, and Batman's walking away from him and his hands are like waving in the air, like, all right, I give up. Which is just great body language and great, you know, Neil Adams. You know, it's just terrific. But the thing is that it also reminds you that you can have a dark, quote, avenging Batman, but you can also give him a personality.
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne has a personality in this story. Batman has a personality. He thinks like a, you know, he's not this taciturn, you know, emotionally constipated, you know, almost robot. You know, he's not a bat robot. He's Batman. And what I love about this is that it captures both of those elements of the character. He is a person, but he's also this grim avenger, and he's, you know, of course, always up to the challenge. Plus, putting it in the House of Mystery is great because the narration is hysterical.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Again, like you said, this is a classic story, and actually Ryan and Chris Franklin covered this a little while ago over on their show. But one of the things I love about it is that the story itself is pretty serious in terms of all the story beats, but then you've got these cut-ins by Kane where he's sort of puncturing it all. I mean, like the scene where Bruce Wayne can't sleep, and then you cut to Kane going, rock-a-bye, Brucey, and he's like sort of making fun of it. So even though this is Brave and the Bold, which means it's a Batman story, so it's the House of Mystery guest starring in a Batman comic. Right. It still feels like a House of Mystery story because Kane is appearing. He's doing the Rod Serling bit where he's appearing in the scenes at any given moment. He's there. He's pointing at Batman, and then he's the one who finishes the story. And it features some nice little, you mentioned about the personality. I love that when Batman gets the antidote, when he lunges over the table and that kind of desperate, it's almost undignified for Batman, which is fun. Like, you don't get to see that very much. No. It's like, as you say, he's Batman. And I like that he's like, give me the antidote. I mean, he's not saying it, but through Adams's body language, that's kind of the read on it, which is really cool. And also, I didn't mention the colorist. This was colored by Bob LaRose, and boy, is this thing colored within an inch of its life.
Oh,
he did
beautiful.
Such a good job.
It's so beautiful. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because like you look at the pages. And there are, and this was a trick that they used quite a bit in the Bronze Age anyway, where it was monochromatic, where basically it was a black and white scene, but it was with one color yep. over the entire scene. Different shades, of course, but the scene where Batman is carrying the boy out of the castle, and it's like this pink and magenta hue, you know, that just gives you a sense of what the sky looks like, and, yep. and it's just it's just gorgeous. And yeah. and you know, and anytime, of course, they show Kane, he's in green, whether he's popping up on somebody's shoulder or whether it's his, you know, he's basically black and white, but he's black and green. And all of those things, all of those little tricks really, really work. And that's why I love seeing these books done in their original coloring as opposed to a lot of the trades where they mm-hmm, recolored stuff. Mm-hmm. And it really misses that artistry, that sense of – I mean, there is a real fine line between being photorealistic, which is what Adams was, and, you know, he really pioneered that kind of – that art style. That's why I consider him to be the greatest artist who ever lived when it comes to comics. I'm sorry, Kirby folks. I don't mean any disrespect, but you know, Adams to me really is the pinnacle. But it's the fact that he looked like a person. But when it comes down to the coloring, you know, you can over render something to within an inch of its life sometimes.
Yeah,
and,
oh yeah.
And
yep.
and color really has a lot to do with it. So this really does give you an appreciation of the skill that goes into it, because there's not an off note in this entire story.
Yeah, it just really gorgeous. Is. Yeah, it really is superb. It's great, and it fits in so well with what, as you talked about, O'Neill and Adams were doing. We're returning yeah. Batman to that supernatural,
yep. Yep.
spooky thing with gothic mansions and stuff like that. And again, even with the humor, and also there are a bunch of Batman panels by Adams that you've seen repurposed
yes.
in other things. There's the page 17 where it's the five panels where Batman's just beating the crap out of that guy,
yeah.
smashing with the chair. And then that bottom panel where he's got the guy by the shirt and he's like, "Where's the youngster? Answer! You'll regret the day you were born."
Yes.
I've seen that drawing repurposed in a bunch of different places.
Yeah.
So it's like they got their use out of this. They were like, "Oh, Neil Adams just gave us about half a dozen iconic Batman shots in one story."
It's really true. And it's again, it is also the fact that he's got that Batman menacing thing down, but yet also when Batman isn't doing that, he's almost like a regular guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like his internal monologue, and this is another example where I really do prefer the internal monologue to like the little boxes that they do in today's comics, which I think actually take away from the drama. I don't mind the thought balloons. I don't mind hearing what he's saying to himself as he's going through whatever his paces are, because his tone changes. You know, what he's saying to himself versus what he's saying to whoever he's confronting really gives you that sense of how Batman thinks internally, but then how he presents himself externally. And having that contrast, I think, is actually what humanizes this version of Batman, and which is what makes it my favorite version of all of them over the years when it comes to comics, is that the Bronze Age Batman, even though there's some weirdness and some goofiness because there's some Silver Age holdover, and you know the comics as a whole were really evolving at this time, but you really get a sense, and this is the Batman I really fell in love with the comics, and the Batman who would inspire me, you know, as a kid, you know what, when you're up against the you know, really tough obstacle to, you know, to stay within yourself and to always look for a solution. And that doesn't mean you have to be like this, again, emotionally constipated kind of asshole, you
right.
know?
Leg breaker and, you know, stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you don't need it. I mean, kind of what made Dark Knight Returns years later work so well was because it was taking it to its logical extreme. It was never meant to be every Batman story written that way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, even Batman Year One isn't like that, you know.
Right,
it's
right.
closer to this. But anyway, I love this story. I have to apologize to the story because I would have included it in my top 13. And there you have it.
It is amazing to think this story is what, 2 years out from the Batman TV series. Like how malleable yeah. this character is
about,
that you
yeah.
could do this. Well, and just 2 years ago, he was taking on Joan Collins as the Siren. I mean,
yeah.
it's unreal.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little spoiler alert. I'm actually planning some columns for later this summer about that transition and about the last
oh,
couple
cool.
of yeah, and that's also why the timing of doing this podcast really works, because since I've been reading, right now I'm in the middle of 1970, or actually toward the end of 1970. And to read the evolution of 1968 to 1970 and what happened to the character and the things that they tried that worked and the things that they tried that didn't work is really remarkable to watch it as it evolved, because they were making such a conscious effort to this is kind of what Julius Schwartz wanted to do back in 1964. Mm-hmm. But it was the medium hadn't evolved enough yet. And then the show came along, and then things got campy. And then finally, after the show was canceled, there's a lot of reasons for this. I don't want to get off too far off point. But the point being is that they were able to finally take the steps to bring this basically the Batman that we know today. This is, again, different than the Batman that's necessarily being written about in the comics today. But there's a real through line. Anyway, I could go on. I will go on in another forum, but I think we have another story to talk about.
We do. One last detail I wanted to mention that I didn't get to in the synopsis is that on the cruise ship, Batman actually throws his costume into the ocean. He's like, I'm giving Batman a vacation. I'm not. If I have the costume, I'm going to put it on. So right. I'm going to just toss it into the sea. And then when he wakes up, he finds the costume mysteriously has reappeared on him, which is the work of Kane, presumably, or something. And so I like that detail. And I have to wonder if you're Batman, you're just like, I'm never going to be able to get away from this. Even when I throw the costume away,
right?
Somebody shows up and sticks it on me. I mean, I'm just destined for this the rest of my life. So, yeah, it's a great story. It's a perfect fit for Strange's Cases and a great way to lead off the book. So, okay, let's get to the next story, which is Night of the Bat from Swamp Thing number 7 by Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson. Swamp Thing traces Matt Cable and Abigail Arcane to Gotham City. The police spot him, and soon Commissioner Gordon summons Batman for help, because of course he does. While Batman hunts for Swamp Thing, the muck monster follows leads, which eventually lead him to Matt and Abby. He rescues them and then is found by Batman. Batman starts a fight, but Swamp Thing tries to avoid the conflict. Unable to communicate his true intentions, Swamp Thing runs away. He then tracks down Nathan Ellery, the head of the Conclave, the organization which killed Linda Holland. Swamp Thing has an opportunity to take revenge, but he holds back. Ellery still dies during an accidental fall. Batman arrives too late to save Ellery, and Swamp Thing has already disappeared. So, I've said on multiple episodes of this show that I think the number one treasury that DC didn't do that they should have done was Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
The Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson, and Swamp Thing. And this is the closest we're obviously ever going to get, because this is the one story of the classic Swamp Thing done in a treasury form. And like the other one, it's a masterpiece. It's just a fantastic story.
Yeah, it really is a great story. And what I love about it also is that the inherent sense of humor in the story too, because really when you think about it, it's Swamp Thing Private Eye. Yeah, it really is. I mean, all of the sort of gothic swamp, atmospheric quality of the issues that led up to this. And of course, even if you're reading this, it works perfectly well on its own, because the way the backstory is interwoven into the story, that you can just read this on its own and it holds up beautifully, is it. This is now a Swamp Thing in the big city. And of course, what is the first thing he does is that he goes and bursts into a place and grabs himself a fedora and a trench coat. I mean, he's great, and it's not played for laughs. It's like, okay, this is what he would do, because he's like, well, I can't really stand out looking like this and shambling along. I better put some clothes on. And it's great. It reminds you of Ben Grimm when he would wear a fedora and a trench coat.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't wonder whether this wasn't some kind of homage to that. But yeah, it's basically what I love about it is the parallels. It's Batman going through the city trying to find the same information as Swamp Thing, and they're both going through the city in very similar fashion. And actually, Swamp Thing is having more success than Batman is, but it's a totally urban story. And it's wonderfully rendered. I mean, this is, you're talking, one of the comic masters, Bernie Wrightson here, but this is, it's just great. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing how things can work in different contexts. Because I remember watching the Swamp Thing TV series, that awful syndicated show, and we used to watch it back when we were all at the Joe Kubert School, and of course it was right in our wheelhouse. And there was an episode where Swamp Thing goes to the big city to chase Arcane or something, and we were just howling with laughter at how cheesy it looked to have this guy in this Swamp Thing costume. And we were like, there's a point where he's like hiding in like a the shadow of like a brownstone, and he's like trying to look around, and we're like yelling like taxi, it just looked ridiculous. But yet when drawn by Bernie Wrightson, it looks it makes perfect sense. Right. It fits in perfectly. It looks great. And again, even though we are Batman is appearing in a Swamp Thing comic.
Right.
This is not the other way around. I love that it's sort of through some visual touches that Bernie Wrightson throws in, Batman is clearly in Swamp Thing's world. And one of the things I noticed even as a kid was on page 4 of this story where we go to the Wayne Manor – or no, the office in the Wayne Foundation building. No, not Wayne Manor. And Batman is about to put on his costume and we see that his cowl and his cape – are not hanging up. They are sitting on a chair.
Yes.
And the chair has this demonic claw as the arm piece. And it's like, what the hell is that? That's like something Anton Arcane would have. But because it's the Bernie Wrightson universe, that's how Batman tricks out his stuff. I mean, imagine putting that in your office. You know, is this thing that's like, what the, is this made of human flesh? What is this thing?
Like, it's true. And the way the Batman's, the mask is cocked, he's standing over wearing a sleeveless t-shirt, you know, his undershirt, and he's about to put his cowl on, and the cowl, it looks like it's got a life of its own. It's like he's now about to transform into this character, and you're right, you see that claw and you know coming out from underneath the cape, and it's just, this is like, it does, it's like Bernie Wrightson having a field day. I also like that Bruce really needs a haircut here. I don't know if you noticed.
He looks like Hawkeye Pierce. He's got super long hair.
He really does. It's like, I mean, I think that, you know, it's like the other panels don't really seem to show that, but here it's almost like, well, he has a lot. He's being Batman. He doesn't have time to get a haircut.
It's the 70s, you know?
It's the 70s. There's a little yeah, exactly. Little hip. But again, this is another case where they showed that Bruce Wayne had a separate life too, that he ran this company and that he did, you know, that he wasn't just this one note character. He had multiple things going on, and that he was fighting for his, you know, he was doing his mission on multiple fronts. He was doing it as Batman straight up. And then of course he was doing things as Bruce Wayne. Cause you see that Bruce Wayne is very, very skeptical of, you know, Nathan Ellery.
Yeah.
He's very skeptical of him, and I like that they show that. But it also shows this is the multiple side of Batman.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not handing off the Wayne Foundation business to Rutger Hauer or anything. He's handling it all himself.
Right.
I love the laugh. And again, this is probably in Len Wein's script, but I mean, Wrightson really does a great job. And again, on page 5, where Batman's down at the waterfront and he's threatening the one guy, and you see the guy with the fish hook behind him, and Batman just takes the guy out from behind without even looking, which is great. That's just a great, you know, chud. You know, he just knocks the guy over. He doesn't
chud
even really.
Is one of the great sound effects. Because, yeah, you see his teeth flying out.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, and you know, That became such a cliche about the way Batman was able to operate that they even kind of did it on in the Batman 89 movie where they show him inside Axis Chemicals. And
oh, that's right. Yeah,
down,
yeah, yeah.
And Batman's waiting for him to come down the corridor, and he just sticks out his arm and whacks him, and the guy just drops.
Imagine having enough forearm strength to knock someone out, hitting them backwards.
Yeah,
you know, like
exactly.
That's really tough. And this story also features a panel that I've seen in a million other articles and stories about where they talk about how Batman visually is so malleable. On page 12, where Batman is standing astride two buildings, and he said, it says, that dog fits the commissioner's description. No monster with him, but he's still worth checking out. And Batman's cape looks like it's about 30 feet long.
Yeah.
I mean, like the wind is behind him, and it's ridiculous, but it fits because he's in the world of Swamp Thing, so it makes total sense. Again, Wrightson is just, like we talked about with Adams, it looks like Wrightson's just having the time of his life. And I can only imagine when he got the script from Len Wein, or whenever they first, you know, came up with this idea that, all right, we're around number 7, we're going to bring in Batman now. Wrightson must have been like, yes, so fun. Yes, not Superman, Batman. This is perfect.
Yeah. And it's true, that image of him, and you're right, with him astride the two buildings, and the way, and how tight, you could tell how the wind is blowing. Not just by the fact that his cape looks 30 feet long, but how tight it is against his
it's
body
wrapping
from
around
behind.
His body, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a visual trick that really jumps out at you when you look at it. You're like, geez. I also like when you turn the page and you see, again, you know, there's so much jammed into these stories. And I mean that in a good way. The number of panels in certain respects that Wein and Wrightson used to tell the story. And again, I'm not sure how much of that was Wein and how much of that was was Wrightson, because Ween, as I understand it, preferred to work in like Marvel fashion, where he would and this would suggest then that it was a lot of, you know, Wrightson's doing in terms of how many panels he wanted and what have you. Because my understanding is the reason why Marshall Rogers didn't like working with Len Wein was because Marshall Rogers really liked having a full script, and Wein wasn't the kind of guy who gave full scripts. And I'm not sure if that's always been the case or not. I don't want to speak out of turn, and if I'd be happy to be corrected. But it really does feel like a collaboration between writer and artist in this. And it's a masterwork.
Yeah, and also features that other panel on page 16 of Batman kicking Swamp Thing pretty much in the nards. There's no way to avoid it.
Yeah.
And the camera is behind, but it's an angle you've almost never seen.
Yeah.
Or probably you have at this point. But in 1972, it was still pretty novel to see Batman from the back, where you literally don't see his head because his cape is covering it.
Right.
And you're seeing him sort of just, you know, from behind. Wrightson really having an amazing time. And then I also do like when Swamp Thing finally gets tired of this, and he just catches Batman's fist. He's just like, all right. And then he just kind of, the next panel, he knocks him out. And the way that Wrightson draws Swamp Thing's fist, you can tell Swamp Thing's not even hitting him that hard. He's just kind of like, bop. Batman's like, that's enough of this. Boom. He's like, okay, take Batman out momentarily. It's a perfect distillation of both these characters.
But what I love about that, like, is the juxtaposition. When you show that shot from behind, which is great, but every single muscle, every single muscle of his is taut. It's like he is putting every ounce of effort to go troom and try to take out Swamp Thing. And not only does he fail to take him out, but then like you say, Swamp Thing, you know, he's like, all right, I've had enough of this. And they just like, and then that's it. Batman's out. Batman. So it just shows you the difference in their strengths, the difference in their abilities. And just that, I always remember that shot where he just stops Batman's fist cold, because nobody does that to Batman, and and he's holding on to it, and he just knocks him with his left, like thud, and then out. Love it.
Yeah, that's a great story. And final on the last page, because this story featured some of those half pages, they had a half page to fill. They stick an ad in for the DC special, which was reprinting the original Swamp Thing saga.
Yes.
It's like, guys, you're teasing me. It's right there.
I know.
Just make it a little bigger. Damn it, DC. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, what are you going to do? So, all right. So the third story is The Batman That Nobody Knows. It's from Batman number 250 by Frank Robbins and Dick Giordano. While on a camping trip with three underprivileged kids, Bruce Wayne finds himself amused how all the kids describe Batman. One of them sees him as a sort of half-human, half-bat creature. Another sees him as a combination of Shaft and Iron Man, tricked out with all sorts of high-tech gear. The third describes him as a 10-foot-tall, silent, almost shadow-like being. Bruce, amused by all this, comes out of the shadows dressed in his Batman costume, thinking he'll give the kids a little shock. But they simply yawn at their host playing dress-up and go to sleep. Batman thinks to himself, of course, the Dark Knight only scares the guilty, not the innocent. So what a marvelous change-up from these two stories to stick this one in. Because I love this story. I think it is so completely charming. And obviously, the people that did the Batman the Animated Series thought it was charming, because they basically adapted it into an episode.
Yeah, they did the same thing also with one of their direct-to-video movies, the Batman Gotham Knight, I think, the one that was done by all of the masters. When they did them, one of them also did the first segment is an adaptation of this also, where it's these kids sitting around, in the city, and they're all saying what they think Batman should be like, and then they finally get to see Batman. And yeah, it is. It's only six pages, and it's just absolutely wonderful. It's a six-page – it's also partial character study here. You know, but the different ideas of how each of these kids, and the thing is that if you look at it, each Batman that they think of is all part of who Batman is.
Yes.
You know, he's spooky and he's able to do things that you didn't think that anybody could do, but he's also high tech, and yet he's also intimidating and scary and all of these things. It's just that they've deconstructed him based on what they've heard. And it's both in terms of the way they pace it and the visual representation of the different Batmans. The first one kind of looks like Man-Bat in a Batman costume. The second, totally off, completely off. But this was what inspired the Batwing character that came out in the New 52, Luke Fox's son. And then this latest one, which is kind of the closest to how Batman looks, but it's exaggerated. Mm-hmm. And it's just – I remember reading this one as a kid, and I loved it then.
Yeah, it's really, really cute. And I love even the detail that the Bruce Wayne – the kid is telling the story, and it's – the kid obviously heard the story from a guy that was apprehended by Batman.
Right.
And Batman – and you know, the guy told the story like that he – almost defeated Batman,
right.
and you know, he made himself sound better. And Bruce, it's fun. It's a fun angle for Bruce Wayne or Batman to be hearing what is said about him by the people that he apprehends. And like, he even does like the little face slap thing.
Yeah,
like,
he does.
Oh God, Willie sure piled it on to make himself look good. It's great. It's really fun. And it's a Batman you can't imagine in like the last 20 years.
No,
because as you've talked about, he's. He's, you know, super – the world's greatest face breaker nowadays. And he's so angry all the time. you know, this Batman is like – he takes kids on a camping trip. He takes underprivileged kids on a camping trip.
I know. And that's – and to me, that's – I'm gonna quote the ultimate nerd quote, but that's my Batman.
That's the one.
It's the one that had those – that was able to balance, or the writers were able to balance both. And it's such a poignant ending too. I mean, the kids are like, "Oh, come on, Mr. Wayne, get out of here! Stop playing dress up!" And they see right through him. And then his just kind of he stands there. He's like, "Huh, you know, whatever else it proves, the Batman's frightening image scares the guilty, not the innocent."
Yeah. I love the body language that Jim Adana uses in the next to last panel where the kids are making fun of him, and he's kind of hunched over. He's like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah.
And when are you ever going to see Batman look like that?
Yeah, it's right. It's also the panel above it where he jumps out like in his classic pose and he thinks he's going to impress them, and they're like, "Yeah, whatever."
Yeah, all right, whatever. It's great. It's really cute. It's a real. And again, I love that it's not a strangest case story. I think it stretches the bounds of strangest cases, but it's a nice tonal change after these sort of very dark, gritty things, even though, again, the other stories have humor, but it's just nice to have this sort of cute little drop in. It's almost like a laugh in, like little short sketch kind of thing. But it's really, really cute.
And, you know, the thing is also about it is that it reminds you of just how effing great Dick Giordano was.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You know, I mean, because everybody thinks of him as an inker, but you forget him as a penciler. Ah, such pretty artwork.
Yeah.
You know,
wonderful.
Just I loved Dick Giordano. Loved him.
And his kids look like kids.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do sometimes.
Because a lot of times a lot of artists they draw kids looking like, you know, little men as opposed to
jockeys. They look like just little you know, they don't look like kids. They just look like shrunken adults, kids that have been subjected to white dwarf star technology. And you're like, that's not what kids are. Kids have heads that are bigger. Their eyes are bigger.
Yeah, they're softer chin and, you know, they've got baby fat. And
that's how it works out. It's a wonderful story. So, so next up is The Demon of Gothos Mansion from Batman 227 by Danny O'Neill, Irv Novik, and once again, Dick Giordano. Alfred's niece, Daphne, who has taken a job teaching two children, writes to her uncle telling him that something is amiss. Batman investigates and learns that Daphne's employer is a warlock trying to raise the demon Balak. Of course, Batman tries to rescue Daphne, who is to be sacrificed, but he is caught instead. Batman escapes and encounters the ghost of a girl who had been sacrificed a generation earlier. Batman reaches Daphne just in time to save her and stop the coven from completing their ritual.
Yeah.
All right, so another one. I mean, this is Batman if he wandered into those gothic romance comics that DC did in the early 70s.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, the cover, which is very famous, and that's the one – two of the things that disappoint me about this collection is the fact that they don't tell you what issues the stories come from. I mean, the last story was from Batman 250. This one is from Batman 227, and it also doesn't include the covers, which they really should, because, or at least have a cover gallery or something on one of these pages,
which Marvel used to do. Marvel went out of their way to do that.
Yeah, and DC did with the Ra's al Ghul one too. They showed the covers of those. You know, they did a cover gallery, but the Batman 227 cover is also one of that Neil Adams' most famous ones because it's that. It's that homage to that famous golden age, you know, Batman looming over the castle with, you know, the tiny characters running around in the foreground. And in this case, it's that same thing. And I actually had a chance to talk to Adams about it, you know, during an interview. And we talked about the cover, and he says exactly that. He says, yeah, I was basically doing a riff on a romance cover. You know, I was doing that classic cover, but I was also doing, the romance cover with the idea of the woman running away from the building in the distance and being chased and all of that. But yes, this is right out of that whole world.
The splash page by Irv Novik is one of the great. It's like an image that I just had burned into my head. I must have seen it in other locations outside of just because I didn't have the original comic. And I mean, of course, I had the Treasury. But that image is just a Batman looming with the spooky, like he's outside the castle and there's like the decrepit looking tree. And it reminds me of the Batman model kit from the late 60s he's hanging off the bridge, which actually this is the only model I ever tried to put together was the Batman model kit. And I learned very soon that I had no patience for model building. So
same thing, man, you took the words out of my mouth. It exactly reminds me of that. And also there's a couple of things that are worth noting here. First, again, you talked about, you know, Irv Novik being a jobbing artist, and he was, and I don't mean that as an insult because that's the foundation on which comics are built. Really, are those guys? You know, everybody remembers the Neil Adams, but Neil Adams was only doing maybe every third or fourth issue, where these guys were doing everything in between. You know, Bob Brown and Irv Novik, and you know, some of these other, you know, artists that would come and go. But here, you know, and again, this is because of the context of the way I've been reading. They introduced Novik in 1968. In doing Batman, but because they still were kind of adhering to the Infantino style, the choice of inkers really kind of made Novik, it still existed in that 60s world. And the evolution was once Giordano joined and he started inking Novik, now all of a sudden everything took on a new dimension. So the combination of Novik and Giordano is absolutely brilliant, and it's Giordano who really brings a consistency to what Novik was doing in one issue and what Adams might do in the next issue. So it all looks of a piece. It all looks like the same world. The coloring style here, it's Adrian Roy. I mean, it all looks like these are all standalone stories, but there's a continuity of vision that DC was executing at this time, which was just fantastic where Batman was concerned.
And it ends in an odd way, and I didn't mention this in the synopsis, but Batman sort of falls in love with the girl, and he chases her, and she disappears, and the final panel is Batman actually with his face in his hands, probably
grieving.
Sobbing a little. It's like, wow, what a weird way to end the story. That's not something you would typically see in a Batman story, but O'Neill went for it.
Yeah. The thing that I also – it's now the woman who's in the painting, that Daphne – now Daphne had been introduced in an earlier issue, and she's supposed to be like 20 years old. So it's a little weird that Batman is like falling in love with someone who looks exactly like her, because that's probably – you know, although Batman at this point maybe was only 29. I guess it's not that weird. But yeah, it's the idea that he's entranced, that he's fallen under this spell of this apparition, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does it works, but it also feels a little tacked on to me because it's not necessarily necessary to the story, but it also works. And it gives Batman that kind of, you know, humanity that, again, is really missing. I also like one of my favorite sequences is when he's got the noose around his neck.
Oh, yeah.
He's in the death trap.
Yeah.
And he puts his feet forward and he grabs the torch and he burns the rope. I remember that as a kid. That was such an inspirational sequence from when I was a kid, thinking about how to get at, like I said before, how to get out of a tough situation. And it's metaphorical, of course, but in my mind, I'd be like, well, if Batman could get out of that, then I can do this. and it's stories like this and sequences like this is why I fell in love with comic books.
I like stories where we get to see Batman, his physical prowess, not just the fact that he can punch his way out of things, because we know he can, but his physical dexterity, his gymnastic ability, the fact that he can – because, I mean, you know, hey, everybody listening to this, try and do what Batman did by lifting your legs up past your head – Right. See if that doesn't maybe, you know, tear a tendon here and there. Like, Batman's right. able to exactly. do it. I mean, except for the part about the noose around the neck, it is kind of a Batman 66 kind of ending, you know, yes. cliffhanger of like, how's he yeah. going to get out of this? Oh, I know. Yeah. I'll flip this over and grab the Catwoman's cowl and whatever. But I mean, it's a darker version of that. But it's, I like those. One of my favorite stories of all time of Batman is from World's Finest 269, where he gets buried alive. And they just right. do this long explanation of how he managed to turn around his body inside a coffin.
Right.
Because he's a yoga master. And I'm like, right. I love all that stuff. It's yeah. great. So it's yeah. really cool.
And it's also that he's not – that he's in perfect shape. He's not overly muscled. Like, now he looks like – everybody wants to draw him like Frank Miller did in The Dark Knight, where he's just right. like this hulking thing with all this armor on top of him. Here, he's just a perfectly physically fit athlete.
Yeah,
and he's lean. I mean, when you see him in those days when he was, you know, Superman was, you know, usually more muscular, at least not. I mean, Kurt Swan stuff aside, but like if you'd see the way Adams would draw Superman versus the way that he would draw Batman versus the way he would draw the Flash, they all have different body types.
Right,
and that's the other thing is that so many artists don't bother to draw them with. They basically give everybody the same body type and. You know, the Flash should be leaner, you know. Green Lantern is supposed to be physically fit, but he doesn't necessarily need to be overly muscled. Batman here just looks like he's in tremendous shape. And also he's got willpower to be able to do what he does here because you can feel the strain, but he's able to do it.
And the presence of mind, of course, not to panic. Because, right. I mean, obviously, if you or I were put in a noose, we'd be like,
oh, my God, we'd be dead.
Okay. You know? So, yep. Batman's just like, how do I get out of this one? I'm like, okay, right. great. So, yeah.
Yep.
It's a great, great story. And, yeah, I agree. It is a shame they didn't do the covers, especially because that Neil Adams cover is one of the most iconic images yeah. of Batman ever devised. And they should have found a way to put it in here somewhere. So, so the final story is A Vow from the Grave from Detective Comics 410 by Denny O'Neill once again, Neil Adams once again, and Dick Giordano once again.
Yeah.
Batman chases escaped convict Cano Wiggins. During his pursuit, he encounters four members of an out-of-business sideshow, and one of the performers is killed. Batman captures Wiggins, who is the primary suspect in the murder, but then he realizes Wiggins isn't the killer. It was Goliath the Strongman. Goliath was jealous because he and Wiggins both loved Maud, the fat lady. Batman captures Goliath and brings him to justice for the murder. So, okay, once again, we've been waxing Neil Adams' car throughout this episode. You can't help it because they're going out of their way to pick some of the greatest stories ever done, and Neil Adams is involved in that. But, boy, this splash page. I mean, Jiminy Christmas. Batman chasing after this guy on a rope bridge in the middle of a rainstorm. It is, you could just feel the rain hitting you as this thing, and the amount of inking poor Giordano had to do.
Yeah.
I wonder what he got this from Adams. He's like, really? All right. Okay. Come on, Neil. What are you doing to me? But boy, it is. I mean, the lightning is cracking. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and you actually see the lightning hit something on, you know, in the waterfall.
Yep.
And you could like smell the ozone of a rainstorm,
yep.
of
yep.
a thunderstorm. And also, this is something that Denny O'Neill did quite a bit, is that he had no problem taking Batman outside of Gotham City.
Yes.
He would just simply drop him into places and say, okay, and he'd come up with a contrivance as to why Batman was not in Gotham. And here, you're right. We pick up right in the middle of action. Where Batman is chasing this guy in an environment that looks nothing at all like Gotham City. I have no idea where he is. I have no idea what, you know, where he's supposed to be. And yet it works perfectly, putting him in this kind of otherwise bucolic setting. What I also love is that Batman is having none of it. I mean, he has been chasing this guy and it's been taking him too long, so that you get to the bottom of page two. And you know, the guys, you know, Cano Wiggins has cut the rope. Batman has to leap off the rope bridge, grabs a branch, and then him climbing over the edge of the cliff. And the look on his face is like, I have had enough of you.
I'm tired. I'm wet.
Tired. I'm wet. I'm angry. It is enough. And nobody could draw tense muscles other than like Wrightson, like I mentioned before, but on a regular basis, in the way that Adams was able to show physical strength and physical movement in a still image is absolutely extraordinary. And also his understanding of anatomy. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the way he would have to – he climbs over that edge like he would have to – he's pulling himself over, and you can see it. And he's pissed, and there's water coming off of him. And it's just – it's like nobody – nobody would ever want to face a Batman who looks like that, because you just know now it's it, you know, it's enough, you've had it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Adams's photorealistic style really works. Well, I mean, it always really works, but in this story he manages to pull something off that I think maybe a lot of artists might not be able to pull off, is that when Batman meets the other members of the circus, yeah, and we're introduced to Flippy, the kid, yeah, and it's a kid with born with birth defects where he's got flippers for hands and feet, right, and he's just sort of – and he's mute. And, yeah, you know, a lot of other artists, if they had drawn that, it might have looked comical, yeah, just because, you know, it is sort of comical in a grim sort of way. But Adams is real – by his using his photorealistic style is really able to make it look just tragic. I mean, yeah, you're just look at this poor kid.
Haunting.
And it's, you're just like, oh, this poor, poor kid. And it's not at all, it's not meant to be funny, and it isn't funny. And that's what makes it work, is that this kid, he's an object of pity, because the poor kid is like slumping along on the floor, and you're like, oh God. I hope that Bruce Wayne, like, you know, when he went back to Gotham, like, got the kid out and got the kid into like a school or something. Like, it's just, because you're
dark.
Just, this poor kid deserves better than this.
Yeah, it is really dark, and you know, you get that scene, you know, on page 7 where Batman's looking down on him, and he mentions Flippy, and the look on the kid's face is just mournful, you know, with the gigantic eyes and just these things where the humanity that was injected into these stories, and O'Neill was an absolute master and getting you to feel for the side characters, to feel the situation from an emotional standpoint that a lot of the other writers at the time that were doing Batman could do, but not as well. I mean, this is why Denny O'Neill was also, I mean, we've been going on and on and on about Adams, but let's not forget Denny O'Neill's ability to tell a story, his choice of words, the way, you know, when I was a kid, I used to just half the time jump over the captions just because I wanted to get to the action. But when you actually slow down and read the captions, what O'Neill was doing was almost poetic, almost lyrical in certain respects. And it's really, you put that plus you put it next to Adam's ability to show kind of that mournful atmosphere. And this is a really touching and also kind of upsetting story, because
it is,
these people are, you know, it's Batman meets freaks, you know, I mean, that's really what it is. And in the same way that freaks, you know, of course was exploitative, but also helped to humanize the people in the circus. It's the same thing here. And it's just, again, this is a case where you've got a story that is where you've got everybody who is involved is at the very best of what they could do.
Yeah. I like news. I'm glad you mentioned Danny O'Neill. Cause yes, of course, obviously, recently just passed away, and we did a tribute show to him here on the network. But I mean, I like his narrator here is kind of doing almost like a murder mystery kind of thing. Because when Batman picks up the one guy over his shoulder, and he says in the caption, it says, "Sometime within the past 10 minutes, the Batman made an important observation. Two, in fact, have you?"
Yeah,
which is
funny.
You know, it's like, oh, okay, like, oh, I have to kind of keep up with this. It's funny.
Yeah.
And on that same page, back to Neil Adams, I love that top run of panels where it's just the shot of the van. And it's the van across three panels. And the way the word balloons are structured, we sense that Batman is moving from the back of the van to the front, because we see the balloons traveling through the van, even though we don't see Batman. And he's like, "That's exactly what I was afraid you'd say." And then the third panel, he knocks the guy through the windshield.
That's genius.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
really fun.
It's visual genius. And again, I have no idea if that was Adams who came up with that or if it was written into the script that way by O'Neill. But regardless, you know exactly what's happening, and virtually none of it is happening on screen. You imagine Batman moving right through, and then you see that little piece of him at the end just clobbering the guy. And it's
wonderful. And then the final page is somewhat similar to the final page in the House of Mystery story, what you were talking about in terms of the colors, yeah. Because after the Goliath has been apprehended and everyone walks out and they're on this hill and we see Flippy and the bearded lady, fat lady and the Goliath and Wiggins. And you could tell it's like, once again, it's like dawn.
Yeah,
you know, it's probably about 5:30 in the morning,
right.
And Batman has apprehended him, and we see Flippy actually looks kind of happy a little bit, like he's kind of jumping a little.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's going to be with the fat lady who obviously cares for him. Right. But it's a melancholy ending. But again, I just love that idea that this case has been taking place in the middle of the night. This took all night, and now we're back, and it's the dawn. And again, it's another really really fine ending with the nice little streaks of yellow going across the sky. Yeah. And you mentioned it, this one is Adrian. Is it Adrian Roy who colored this one? This is Bob LaRose. This one's Bob LaRose again. So, again, another underrated guy, Bob LaRose. I feel like I haven't appreciated him as much as I should have. Because, boy, the colors in this thing are just great.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing is that, you know, when you look at all five of these stories, what's amazing is the fact that they are either close to or 50 years old. And they hold up. They hold up wonderfully. They're not hokey. They're not corny. They are of their time, but they're also timeless. And it is, you know, not only just rereading through this treasury, but as I've been talking about, you know, now I'm in the Bronze Age with my reread. It is absolutely a joy to reread these stories after not having read some of them for decades, and to re-experience them. Not quite they're new. I mean, you remember certain things. But the level of detail and all of the different things that go through, it has been an absolutely marvelous exercise. And it really, to me, when I did something last year where I wrote about Batman number 251, you know, the Joker story. And I said how the proof is that in that story alone that the Bronze Age really is the Golden Age. And I still believe that. I really do think that the comics were at their height in the Bronze Age.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And then so the final little feature here is an inside back cover text piece by Mike W. Barr, work by Mike W. Barr, called The Other Strange Cases of the Batman, where he just goes through and lists some other fun stories, Detective 36, Batman 1, Batman 180, Batman 156, and stuff like that. And then there's a drawing of Batman, and it's interesting. It's signed T. Klein, which would be Todd Klein.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that a drawing by Todd Klein? I mean, Todd Klein generally didn't sign his lettering.
No.
And I mean, is that an address? It looks a little Aparo-ish and a little Irv Novik-ish, but I have to wonder, is that an original drawing by Todd Klein?
That's a really good question. And I think that the Batman head was used as used in Detective Comics sometimes as like, you know, the little floating head that they would have on the cover. The head looks familiar beyond this image, but you're right. I don't, it is signed Todd Klein, which is weird. So I don't know. I mean,
Maybe he composed it. Maybe he took the head and then put it in because on the background, there's like this cross hatching effect with the shadow. So maybe he put that together or something like that. But again, it's a nice little piece.
That was an Adams trick too, the cross hatching and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, who knows, but it is a great image.
Yeah. And it's a nice little piece. I always love these text things. I always liked Mike W. Barr. I was always a fan of his and it's fun. It's a nice little thing of like, hey, there's other stories you can go and check out. Not that you could get them anywhere, kids of 1978, because comic stores don't exist yet and there are no trade paperbacks, but in case you ever see these laying around somewhere, you might want to check them out. So overall, Batman Strange's Cases, it's a damn shame that this was DC's essentially their final treasury they did Batman versus the Hulk until I don't mean to obviously to dismiss that comic, but this was the last of like a collection of stories that they would put together. And it's such a shame because they went out on a winner. This is a great, great book.
Yeah. As I understand it, it was Jeanette Kahn who was not really big on reprints. That when she came in, that she wanted to really push new material, which made sense. I mean, it really, especially where DC was concerned, where they were, you know, versus Marvel at this time, you know, the mid to late 70s, that she really wanted to push new material, you know, all of that. So that's why a lot of those, you know, when they went to the Dollar Comics format, it was all new material. And they stopped doing reprints. And I think that's probably why the treasuries switched over also. But like for whatever the reason, whether that she had anything to do with it or whether, you know, whether it was an edict, or whether this was just a happenstance, you're right. They go out with a bang because these are five great stories.
Yeah, it's a great, great collection. So I think that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Dan, thank you once again for coming back. I know inviting you to talk about Batman is not a hard lift in any respect. No. And I got into it. I'm wearing a Batman t-shirt right now during this whole recording. So I really went for the verisimilitude of it. So, of course, everyone knows where they can find you, but mention it anyway. Where can they? Sure. Where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. 13th Dimension, the website that I run and that you occasionally contribute to. Mm-hmm. Which I'm always happy when you do, and you can follow the site on Twitter and Facebook. Very active in both places, but pretty much you'll see new material at the site every day.
Excellent. So, okay, everybody, thank you for listening. I want you to stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes and a new mission. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin. The new Nightcast chronicles the Dark Knight Detective's greatest adventures from our favorite comic book creators.
What a novel approach, talking about the comics we actually enjoy.
I know, right?
Highlights from this bold new era of Batman Nightcast include...
The Joker's Laughing Fish.
The Saga of Ra's al Ghul.
Is that how we're pronouncing it?
Yes.
Okay. Batman versus the Man-Bat.
And the first appearance of villains like Clayface 3 and the Ventriloquist.
Plus more great stories by the likes of Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers.
Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams.
Alan Grant and Norm frickin' Brayfogel.
Irv Novick.
Don Newton.
Doug Munch.
Dick Sprang.
Max Allen Collins.
No, what?
Just messing with you.
Wasn't funny.
Batman Nightcast, every month from the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
The Long Halloween, Hush, Dark Knight Returns, The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad overlooked.
And that's where we come in. Hi everybody, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index index show.
Our goal is to talk about the previously mentioned overlooked stories and tell you why they're worth your time.
The show comes out twice a month, with the first episode focusing on the Bat books from the late 70s and early 80s. We're starting with the Len Wein run and working our way forward through the books written by Jerry Conway and eventually Doug Mensch.
On the second episode of the month, we'll dig into the various adventure comics that were based on the Fox Kids / Kids WB Batman animated shows because they're really good and hardly anyone seems to remember that they exist.
The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
And it's time for listener feedback, and we're going to be covering the feedback from the previous episode, which was Treasury Cast number 48, famous first edition All-Star Comics number 3, with my guest Gord Tolton. But before we get to that, we have another new iTunes review, Apple Podcast review. Thank you so much. It's so exciting to see these reviews flooding in. So the new review is from Protective Gatsby. I don't know what that means. And it says, a big fun 5 stars. My second favorite podcast, on a network full of strong content. Being a kid in the 1970s, I had a ton of Treasury formatted comics, and most episodes bring back memories. The host is a knowledgeable pro, and the subject matter spans different companies and time periods. Now I'm just waiting until my favorite Treasury is covered, C-52 Best of DC. Thank you, Gatsby. I tip my martini glass to you. What's your favorite podcast? Maybe I don't want to know. Anyway, thank you so much for the 5-star review. And yes, at some point, we will be getting to Best of DC – limited collector's edition C-52, because boy, do I love that book. So again, thank you so much for the Apple Podcast review. I really do appreciate it. So yeah, now let's get on to the feedback from the website, finewaterpodcast.com. First up is a comment from Jonathan, who says, I love this comic. My copy looks like it was mauled by a bear. My favorite story is The Spectre. It has a legit supervillain and the best dialogue. Ha ha, death, death, hee, ooms, trickery. And I like how on the cover in the last panel, Spectre's face looks like Dean Martin. Least favorite is The Green Lantern. I have no memory of the story, but by the end of the book, the last thing I wanted was another bunch of guys in suits. That's a fair criticism, Jonathan. And yeah, I never realized, but yeah, Spectre does kind of look like Dean Martin on the cover of famous first edition All-Star number 3. Interesting. Brian Linton says, thanks for another excellent episode, gentlemen. Seeing how the Spectre is portrayed as a cosmic entity in modern comics, I always find it a little funny to see him in these early comics just sitting around shooting the breeze with the guys. I think I like the Spectre more when he occupies the middle ground between those two extremes. Regardless, I enjoyed your coverage of this historic issue. Thank you, Brian. What's the middle ground between those two extremes? Is that the 70s one where he was turning villains into wood and buzzsawing them and stuff? I'd love to know, Brian, what's your version of middle ground when it comes to the Spectre? Martin Gray says, I've never had this treasury, but I would have loved it. I've read the comic, of course, but didn't remember Gardner Fox beginning things by calling Johnny Thunder a local idiot. Rob, you are just mean. My favorite story is definitely Hawkman and Hawkgirls for that astonishing art. Rob's worried to point out that the scene of hero and heroine in sophisticated civvies, they are just smoldering hot, and how refreshing to see an African character not drawn as a horrific caricature. That shadowy killer in the Spectre strip is genuinely eerie, while Adam looks like to have invented thong parties decades before Mike Diodato made Wonder Woman require a bikini wax. Great chat all around, the kind of book this significant deserves. Thank you. Well, thank you, Martin. Charles Coletta, who of course was just on the Treasury Cast in the previous episode, says, great conversation, gents. I'm always glad to hear some Golden Age and JSA discussion. Yeah, me too. As we talked about, I wish there had been a full Justice Society Treasury. It's a shame that this is kind of their only shot at Treasury fame. Edo Bosnar says, first, I have to say how much I can relate to some of Gord's childhood experiences, since I, too, grew up in a pretty rural area. My family didn't make a living from farming, but we did have a 12-acre piece of land, and my parents often liked to have livestock, like cows and sheep. So I have memories of sometimes bottle feeding calves and lambs. Also, when he mentioned getting comics in an IGA, man, the spinner rack in an IGA in a nearby town was where I found so many of my early comics. As to the issue at hand, I'd completely forgotten that I used to have it until I looked at your gallery post. It is easily the first treasury I ever had, since I had only started to get comics sometime in the late winter, early spring of 1975. It also kind of clears up why I always thought of Ma Hunkel as the Red Tornado. Despite her unflattering appearance here, that and some of Johnny Thunder's antics are part of this book that I remember the best. So thanks not only for another enjoyable show, but also jogging another childhood comics memory. Well, thank you, Edo. And yeah, I love the spinner rack. A spinner rack and an IGA. We didn't have IGAs where I grew up in Philly and then in New Jersey, so I can't relate to that specific store. But supermarkets did have them. So yeah, anytime you saw the spinner rack, it was a big moment. Dr. Ann says, I must have had this treasury as a kid because memories of all these stories definitely flooded back as you discussed the stories, and I can't imagine where else I would have read this. I can remember being struck by the vivid Hawkman art and the crazy text boxes in the Dr. Fate story. But the panel which seems to be burned into my memory is the one of the Thunderbolt kicking Johnny in the ass to send him to the meeting. When Rob mentioned this in the podcast, my mind conjured up the image. A look at the gallery post confirmed it. Thanks for covering this. Great issue and certainly treasury worthy. Thank you, Dr. Ange. Matt Royce. He says, another episode of Treasure Cast to treasure. As a huge JSA fan, I wanted this book for just about as long as I can remember. It's unlikely I'll ever find a copy, but it's a far more achievable than my ever owning an actual copy of All-Star number 3. True that, man. This episode is a nice consolation prize. I mean, yeah, that's what the famous first editions were there for, because obviously those books were inaccessible in the 70s, and now they are beyond inaccessible. So yeah, the treasuries are what we have, at least at the time. Liz Ann Oswald says, it was cool to see Gardner Fox's work. I know him mostly from a reprint of The Flash of Two Worlds and other Barry and Jay crossovers. Yeah, Liz Ann, there is a ton out there. Go check it out. Gardner Fox is pretty talented guy. Of course, Jennifer DeRoss would agree with me on that. And then from our network, Chris Franklin says, what a pleasure to finally have Gord on the network and to cover the first appearance of the JSA to boot. With a handle like Earth to Chris, it goes without saying that I love me some JSA. I first read this comic in the Millennium Edition. I was so happy to finally have it in my grubby little hands. Sheldon Moldoff's Hawkman never fails to amaze me. The man nailed the Alex Raymond style of illustration. It's a shame most folks know him for his rather stiff ghosting of Bob Kane's style on Batman for 20 years and not this. Let's hear more Gord on the network. Working backwards, Chris. Yes, I agree. I'd like to hear more Gord on the network. And regarding Sheldon Moldoff, I'm glad you pointed that out because as a kid, I only knew Sheldon Moldoff from what you're talking about, which was the ghosting of Bob Kane. And I was like, this guy's terrible. I mean, really, I just thought it was the work was just awful. And then later on, I would see these early books and see the Sheldon Moldoff. I almost was like, wait, is this the same guy? I mean, how many Sheldon Moldoffs can there be? So it always confused me that he seemed to have two distinct styles like that. But you're right. It would be a shame if like me as a kid, you only knew him from the really kind of rough Bob Kane swipes and not what he was actually capable of doing, like you can see here in the famous first edition, which is just gorgeous stuff. So yeah, go back, everybody, go back and find some Sheldon Moldoff from when he wasn't ghosting Bob Kane. You'll be amazed at the quality of the work. And then finally, a little Russell Burbitt says, this is the only famous first edition book I got because I already had all the origins of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Captain Marvel in the DC Secret Origins book and didn't care about these also-ran Golden Age characters featured in the limited collector's editions. This, however, I had to have. I was always a fan of the Justice Society, and back in the 70s, there was a dearth of JSA reprints available, so of course I bought this. Today, it's one of the only treasuries I still have, probably because it didn't have a diorama on anything on the back that I cut it up. Yeah, the famous first editions luckily weren't subjected to that butchery by kids because they didn't have the dioramas on the back. So, yeah, I'm glad that you still have it, Russell. Thank you for commenting. So that is going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Big, big thanks to my pal Dan Greenfield for coming back and talking Batman. We always enjoy doing that together. Dan's the hugest one of the – I was about to say the hugest Batman fan I know, but I don't know if that's exactly true, but he's – one of certainly the biggest Batman fans I know. His Batman phase never ended. So big thanks for him for coming back and doing the show with me. Thanks, everybody, for the comments. Of course, if you want to talk Treasury Comics, we're always doing that over on Twitter, which is at Treasury Comics. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you want to support the Fine Order Podcast Network, you can go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So if you want to support the network through TreasuryCast, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts, and you can get named here on the show. So this is episode 49, which means, of course, next month's episode, the August episode, will be episode 50. And continuing a tradition seen in comic books, we're going to do something a little special to celebrate that milestone. It's going to be a little bit different. Instead of profiling a specific treasury, I am going to be presenting an interview with someone who loves the treasuries as much as I do and has actually done some treasuries of his own. So yes, everybody, I'm here to announce that for the 50th episode of Treasury Cast, we will be featuring an interview with the great Alex Ross. That's all I'm going to say about it for now. Just have to listen to it. I've been sitting on this for a little while, and I'm really excited to finally announce it. So come back, everybody, next month to hear my talk with Alex Ross. It's a true delight for any comics fan and especially any Treasury fans out there, which, of course, includes all of you. That's why you're listening to this. So until next month, go big or go home.
Classic! Of course, that's just the tip of the Batberg. My Bat Trophy Room goes on forever!